Students get a 10% discount on everything. Head out to the Quality Inn 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. on Thursday and Friday, and then on Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. for great deals on outerwear and sports apparel.
And good afternoon. It's 4 o'clock. Thanks for tuning in to CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located here in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce, and this is Finding a Voice, a spoken word program airing here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. And we do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. Coming up on the show today, in the first hour, you'll hear a September 29th Novel Idea bookstore launch of the book When Genocide Wasn't News. Martin Lukacs, journalist, author, managing editor of news website The Breach, and co-editor of this provocative collection of essays critiquing Canadian media treatment of Gaza. He was joined by Professor of History here at Queen's, Ariel Saltzman, in a very full and interesting discussion that evening. The event did last nearly 78 minutes, so this certainly will air well into the second hour, but I'm letting you know it will air uninterrupted as well into the second hour. And then in the second hour, the remainder, about the last quarter of the show, I guess, the remainder will feature, after the book launch ends, a bit of music and also mostly, though, a list of local literature information like calls for submissions and events. Just the top of the hour thing is I'd like to mention that occasionally some poetry, music, or spoken word on this show may contain strong language, and I try to preserve that as much as possible to honor the creative integrity of both the author and the piece. And something I usually do at the end of the hour, but won't be able to at the end of this first hour, so I'll do it now. I'll do it again at least once more and before the end of the show. But just a reminder that with all shows here each week, I upload them to my personal blog space for the show at Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com after I get home in the evening. And it will remain on that site for 3 years. So let's go ahead with, again, the book launch event. Again, in case you tuned in a minute or so late, I'll just reintroduce it. September 29th, Novel Idea book launch of the book When Genocide Wasn't News. Martin Lukacs, journalist, author, managing editor of the news website The Breach, and co-editor of this book, which is a provocative, it's called a provocative collection of essays critiquing Canadian media treatment of Gaza. He was joined with Professor of History at Queen's, Ariel Saltzman, in a very full and interesting discussion that evening. Again, this will run well into the second hour, and it will run uninterrupted. So here we go.
We're just waiting to see if any more people come, just to be fair to them. Sorry to hold you all up.
Profession will be late.
30 years.
Yeah, I think people are pretty well set.
First of all, thanks everybody for being here. And this event is sponsored by Independent Jewish Voices, which we're a group that's dedicated to peace and justice for all people. And I'd like to also thank Novel Idea for standing up for freedom of thought and exchange of ideas forever. So, and hosting or providing space for this event. And I also want to give a great welcome to our two guests, Martin Lukacs and Ariel Saltzman. And Martin is works with Breach Press, and Breach Press and Martin try and bring light to what we endlessly see attempts to create darkness. So I want to thank them for that. And Ariel has been is an expert and a scholar on the subject of economic development in the Middle East for many years, and the capitalist effects of capitalism on the society. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, that's a fair summary.
Be sure I got that right. So thank you. I'm going to stop talking and let other people
talk. Thank you. Thank you, Matthew. Yeah, I think you better go around. Maybe it's too tight. Anyway. Yeah, thanks, everybody, for coming. And again, thank you, Oscar and Novel Idea. Thank you, Martin Lukacs, for being here. He's one of the co-editors of this wonderful book that just came out. And it's really a first, at least as far as I'm concerned, in the English language world. I don't know whether there's anything in French or European languages or in Arabic, etc. As Matthew said, Martin is a journalist who's worked for mainstream newspapers on both sides of the Atlantic, and now is managing editor of The Breach and publishers of this volume. And I just wanted to start out with the timeliness of this volume, and perhaps Martin, you can speak to that in the sort of Canadian context, both in terms of the media, but how the media and how the government continues to regard an ongoing genocide in Palestine.
Thank you so much for the introduction and to IJV for organizing this event, and thanks to everyone for coming tonight. It's great to see some friendly faces, and also I want to shout out Helga, who is an amazing organizer who I got to know 20 years ago. She went to the West Bank the year before I did, and worked with the International Solidarity Movement, which is it's not around anymore, but was a really important organization doing nonviolent civil resistance alongside Palestinians against the occupation. And actually, that's for me the roots of my work on this issue. I traveled to Israel actually on a trip called Birthright, which is for people who don't know, a free trip for young Jewish people that's intended to strengthen the sense of loyalty that Jews abroad in the diaspora have to Israel. It's an all paid for trip. They fly you in. You get to party on the beach. You travel to Eilat. They have you mingle with Israeli soldiers, and they tell you that if you meet someone and fall in love, they'll pay for your wedding. And so it's like for young Jewish people who have been raised with myths about Israel, it's really this kind of emotional culmination of that upbringing. I use the trip for a naughtier purpose. At the end of it, you can extend your trip and, you know, travel back to the beach. But I asked them to put me off on the way to the airport in East Jerusalem. And I'll never forget the response when I was asking to be taken off the bus, and they were like, "That's where the Arabs live." Then I traveled to the West Bank and worked with the International Solidarity Movement. The experiences I had were 180 degrees away from the things I had learned on that trip. Far from a kind of bloodthirsty people that I was instructed to imagine live there, I met a people of incredible, astonishing generosity work doing nonviolent resistance against the beginnings of the apartheid wall that was being built, which, you know, snaked into Palestinian territory and appropriated olive groves and parts of Palestinian towns, expanding the reach of the occupation into Palestinian land. And the thing that most actually transformed my thinking wasn't actually being there sometimes getting shot at by the Israeli military working alongside Palestinians. It was actually coming back to Canada and starting to read the mainstream media again. My parents subscribed to the Globe and Mail, so that was the newspaper I read. And I remember just being floored by the web of deceit that they spun. How a people that I had just met were turned into a bloodthirsty people. How in the pages of the newspapers, like the Globe, rocks somehow became a match for tanks. And how a people that I had come to understand were desperate for peace were made out to be people lusting for blood. And that completely seared me intellectually and helped me understand the amorality of stenographers in the media in the West, and how when you want to steal a people's land and their life, you first have to steal their humanity and their history. And that's what the Western media has done over generations to the Palestinians. And I think it's a realization that over the last 2 years, millions more people have come to understand, as we have all been, witness to this live stream genocide, and then seen what we see in front of our eyes, and then turn to the broadcasts and the pages of the mainstream media, and just see a completely different picture, complete whitewashing of this genocide. That outlook is what has shaped the work we do at The Breach, which has been to try to meticulously and empirically document that anti-Palestinian bias in the media and try to educate and extend people's, growing understanding about the treatment that the media gives, not just to Palestinians, but to any oppressed peoples the world over.
And I think we also have to acknowledge, and you do in this book, in one of the final chapters, by the translation of a Palestinian, very young Palestinian journalist, some 278 journalists and media workers within Gaza have been systematically killed. We wouldn't know this were it not for this absolute heroism. These people are very, very young. Very often they're targeted along with their families. Multiple members of their families have died alongside them. So the risk they're taking is not just the risk on themselves, but it actually endangers their entire families. And yet, they have kept going because they know they are the witnesses. There is no international media there. And this is part of the cowardice of the Western media. It's not to say, that, the Israelis won't let us in. They could get in because the physicians are getting in, and various other medical personnel. So they are just basically succumbing to what Israel demands. And that has left, of course, only the Palestinians to tell the story of what's going on, which is at now, sadly, approaching extermination.
We dedicate the book to Palestinian journalists working on the front lines,
right.
Not just being killed but being deliberately assassinated in many cases. And the Israeli military, as we now know, thanks to investigations by a Palestinian-Israeli outlet, 972.
Plus
972. That not only are they targeting Palestinian journalists, but they have a unit that tries to seek out intel in order to deliberately spread misinformation about journalists, make them seem out to be Hamas plants, as a way of legitimizing what Israel is doing.
I think we were talking about this. We are at this critical moment, and this book couldn't come out sooner. It's a wonderful book, and I've read it cover to cover. And I want you to all purchase a copy. What I was going to say, we're also at this moment in Canada. We're still, on the one hand, now belatedly you know, it could have done it in 1947, belatedly recognizing the Palestinian state, at the same time denying the genocide that's happening around them, and pretending that even though Canada is a signatory, has ratified the Convention on Genocide, that the Convention on Genocide actually says the prevention and punishment of genocide. It doesn't just say the punishment of genocide after the fact. So we're at this moment, you know, in this country, and also, you know, why suddenly, you know, why the Canadian public has been left in the dark about the disproportionate nature and the absolute cruelty and horror that Israel has unleashed, we're just shy of 2 years, 24 months, on the entire population of Gaza, half of which, of course, are children who've taken these blows. So I want to go to the book, and I wanted to ask you some of the big takeaways that you learned as you were composing this book, working with other authors, and the other co-editors are Dania Majid and Jason Tony of Canadians
for Justice,
Justice and Peace in the Middle East.
Yeah. No, it's a collaboration between the three of us. Each of us come to the book from different perspectives.
Right.
Dania, for people who don't know, is a powerhouse Palestinian organizer in Toronto. She organizes the Toronto Palestine Film Festival. So she has spent a decade plus trying to get an airing of Palestinian perspectives in the media and in culture. And Jason runs the media program at the CJPME, which basically is an attempt to create a progressive flack machine to counter the reactionary flack from Israel lobby organizations. So I like to joke that the book is basically what happens when a Palestinian, a Jew, and a lapsed Roman Catholic walk into a newsroom and get really, really pissed. Dania describes this not as a book, but an accusation.
Yeah.
And
j'accuse.
Exactly. Really an attempt to level at Canada's establishment media the charge that they have really covered up the destruction of Gaza, which of course didn't start 2 years ago. This has been ongoing for decades. But what we try to do in the book that's a bit different than previous media coverage is really collect the best of independent journalism. And that includes everything from, you know, empirical assessments, really database journalism, just to demonstrate how little Palestinian death matters in the mainstream media as compared to Israeli death. There's a great quote we have from a Palestinian journalist here that the peculiar plight of all oppressed people, including the Palestinians, is that they get killed twice, first in life and then the way that their deaths are reported. And we found that kind of coverage has really connected with people because people feel it in their bones. But it's another thing to see, for instance, how the Western media, for instance, the Canadian media, for instance, in the first 6 weeks alone, we have an article where we show that the Globe and Mail, the Toronto Star, the National Post use the term massacre hundreds of times to refer to what Hamas did on October 7th, but never use the term massacre to refer to what Israel is doing to the Palestinians. And then we have several essays, testimonials from journalists working within the mainstream media at places like the CBC and CTV, really describing how they, you know, all of them incredibly courageous, all of them who risked their jobs and ultimately lost their jobs, who ran up against the hard limits set on truth-telling about Palestine in the mainstream media. So one of the articles that I'm really proud of publishing in The Breach was a piece by Molly Schumann that describes, Molly is a producer at CBC, who was working on news shows, and the essay is basically a narrative about the measures that she ran up against from the upper level management at the CBC, which started with initially commentary from her superiors that, oh, you know, this isn't the right venue for this coverage, or, oh, that might make the anchor uncomfortable, to then pressure to always pre-tape interviews rather than having them on having them live, to, for instance, being pressured to verify that a Palestinian guest who's several of whose family members had just died, verifying that their deaths had in fact happened, which of course is a next impossible task when Israel has destroyed most of the civilian infrastructure in Gaza. And then as she kept pushing, to her credit, the tactics on the part of the upper management escalated. So then she was called into a superior's office and said that, you know, they understand that she's very passionate about this subject, but maybe a mental health leave would be in order. She kept at it because she knew that mental health wasn't the issue. And then ultimately, they leveled the greatest charge that probably was available to them, which was they called her again and said that her colleagues had complained that she was anti-Semitic. Mind you, this journalist herself was half Jewish, and her father was a Holocaust survivor. And she ultimately quit not long after that, not being able to stomach what she was forced to do, and then wrote this essay for us, which I'm proud to say caused many a upper level management meeting at the CBC. We heard that the day it came out, basically the floor was empty, and people were in hurried meetings. CBC put out statements about this journalist, it was good to see that an independent outlet providing a platform for such truth telling could scare a bit of sense into CBC upper management. And that really is just, you know, the things that she experienced are a very symptomatic, classic template that any journalist in the mainstream media who's trying to do that work runs up against. And most often, journalists, once they've experienced just a smidgen of that, end up internalizing it and stop pushing up against those invisible railings and just simply don't cover. Yeah. Don't try to cover
or cut off even sooner, right? So especially, you know, the APR, you know, anti-Palestinian racism, which works its way, you know, when you have, or anti-Arab, when you have journalists who are native speakers of Arabic, you know, bring all this cultural, linguistic capacity to these news programs, and yet they're going to be the first ones to be fired.
Yes.
If they dare to raise their voice.
We have a piece from Pesant Matar, who's an incredible Egyptian-Canadian journalist, who describes how up until she started covering Palestine, some of those skills that she had, like first language Egyptian, were incredibly valuable. They loved it that she would translate things. But as soon as some of her lived experience came into the question on the question of Palestine, they had a very different reaction. And she faced one block after another.
And I was also going to ask you to describe more some of the chapters, and I know that you talk about basically just the just numerically, statistically, you know, how many Palestinians have to die vis-a-vis one Israeli to merit any mention in the press. And I was wondering whether the press actually had an algorithm to determine this in the same way, you have. Yeah, so.
I mean, that's what it sometimes feels.
And it's across the board, right? So it covers from left to right and right to left. It's all the same, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
I think of it as a kind of structural trickle, colonial trickle-down effect, that to my view, the mainstream media, the establishment media in this country move in lockstep with the corporate and political class. Mm-hmm. And Israel has, you know, as you mentioned, for decades, since the 40s, been, a staunch ally of Canada, a client state of the U.S., and therefore a client of Canada. And Canada has been, a ceaseless backer of Israeli expansionism, impunity, and violence. And so the Canadian media has always mirrored that. Mm. And so naturally, or structurally as a consequence of that, our the victims of our violence and of Israel's violence are not seen as worthy victims. Mm. And that trickles down into the kind of coverage that you have of them. So Palestinian deaths are rarely humanized. They're mostly nameless. They died rather than were killed, right, as Israelis were killed. Israelis, by contrast, are humanized, both in photos and in text. There's evocative, emotionally resonant details about their lives. Palestinians, by contrast, don't get that treatment. And one of the most revealing articles in this book, I think, is based on a story that we did based on a letter, actually, that a director of standards at the CDC wrote to someone who wrote a complaint into the paper, and then they shared it with us. And it was incredibly revealing. He had noticed, for instance, that Israeli deaths, at the hands of Hamas, are described as murderous, vicious, brutal. Whereas when CBC reported on the deaths of Palestinians at the hands of the Israeli military, they were described much less evocatively and much more blandly as intensive or unrelenting or punishing. And in this letter that the CBC director of standards wrote to this complainant, she didn't dismiss that. She acknowledged that that was in fact happening, and it was deliberate. That the reason that they did not describe Palestinian deaths that way was because Israelis had been killed in close proximity, but that Palestinians were being killed remotely. As if seeing your child, incinerated in front of you by a missile is somehow less of a death, less of an emotional impact. I found that article was truly, illuminating. In that, so much of the time, I think that the bias, that anti-Palestinian bias we see, is structural, but sometimes, these top-tier editors and managers put their finger on the scale. Yeah. So it's a combination of both.
So, and also in some of these articles, you talk about world-famous authors who were refused a venue in the Canadian press because of their position.
So yes, yes.
Pankaj Mishra.
Yeah, Pankaj Mishra.
And Diana Butu,
yes,
among them.
Yes. Silver lining of the book was that I got to interview one of my heroes, Pankaj Mishra, who is an incredible Indian writer who was given this prestigious award, literary award, and as tends to happen with that award, customarily the lecture is published in the Globe and Mail. And when he sent his piece to the Globe and Mail, he received it back, and every single mention of Israel, 19, were excised from the text. Even a famed author is subject to the same kind of censorship and suppression as a an ordinary, normal reporter in the newsroom.
So, and you also mentioned, I think, one of the articles, the coverage of the protests and how they were covered by the mainstream media. Would you like to elaborate on
sure.
that?
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, there's more research being done on that.
And yeah.
Also,
yeah.
The policing of the protests.
Yeah. I mean, all of us who've been paying attention to, this really incredible upswell of Palestinian solidarity in Canada have not been able to miss how the movement has been smeared in the mainstream press. And to me, that is the flip side of the coin of the smearing and the monstrification that happens to Palestinians in the West media. I think that the media and the political class in this country and others in the West realize that that is the only way really to suppress the truth from getting out.
Yeah.
And so we cover, for instance, the the treatment of the Indigo 11. People who, you know, whatever you might think of the tactic, it is one that is in the classic, you know, playbook of tactics, postering, and the, you know, the, this group of activists postered Indigo with some paint and normal posters highlighting how Heather Reisman has been a big supporter of the Israeli military through the Hesek Foundation, which basically provides grants to lone soldiers who don't have families, who go and conscript in the Israeli army. And all of these individuals were smeared in the entirety of the English language media as anti-Semites, even though some of them happened to be Jewish. And the campaigns against Heather Reisman were started 20 years ago by Women's Voice for Peace and other Jewish organizations like IJV.
Yeah, and the impact of this, which I think is, you know, should be underscored in terms of not just silencing another channel of information and outrage at what's not being covered, but also serves to inflame and distort relations between Jews and non-Jews, Jews and Muslims, Jews and Palestinians, by misrepresenting and smearing these kind of protests, justifiable protests against this horrific situation.
Completely, completely. I mean, one of the instances in which some of this misrepresentation was most brazen was during the student encampments that happened last summer.
Right?
Time goes by. You know, it was an incredible, these students were building incredible diverse coalitions of Jews and Muslims, Palestinians. You know, I live in Montreal, where I attended some of the demonstrations in solidarity there, and you know, these students were holding you know, Muslim prayers as well as Jewish Shabbat dinners, you know, side by side, and yet somehow they were described as these hotbeds of hate in the Canadian media. Obviously, the furthest thing from the truth. So, I think for those who experienced them firsthand, it was a lesson in the lengths to which the mainstream media go in distorting what's happening on the ground.
Yeah, distortion, but also, you know, deliberate division, sowing division. And you know, one of the final chapters written by Jason, right, is on what to do about the media. And I think one of the things that should encourage us is that this joint investigation by Plus 972 and The Guardian may have been the cause for Microsoft. Stopping the use of one of its clouds and to survey Palestinians. But, you know, of course, that's just a small slice of, you know, what these high-tech companies are guilty of in terms of the war. But nonetheless, there was a response.
I think the truth is that despite, you know, the grave horror of what is still unfolding in Gaza, I think the popular upsurge in this country has already had an incredible tangible effect. And that's everything from, you know, the work of CJPME and, and Jason and doing that progressive flack and marshaling, you know, people's energy to correct the mistakes, point out the double standards. I know for a fact that our journalism and the journalism of other really good independent outlets like the Maple, for instance, has done a lot of the incredible investigations documenting how much military arms are still being shipped to Canada despite the, you know, the verbal gymnastics and lies of the Liberal government. And then I think ultimately, so for instance, I mean, we've heard, for instance, that from mainstream journalists that when we publish our exposés and our scoops, it gives them a bit more space to push through stories themselves that tell a bit more truth. And I would say that the biggest impact that I think has happened has been because of popular organizing. It has been impossible for the mainstream media to ignore. I mean, yes, they try to suppress and smear the movements, but for instance, during those encampments, there were regular articles documenting just how much investment Canadian universities, the Canadian government, companies have in building Israeli weaponry, selling Israel arms. All of that stuff has had an effect. I mean, at the breach, we're of the opinion that, you know, it's not journalists that change the world. It's activists and movements mm-hmm. that do. And those changes aren't always immediately evident, but they do have knock-on effects. It changes the culture, and over time, it does have an impact. And I think even in Canada, we have started to see more coverage on the front pages that are starting to show some of the humanity of Palestinians. I think there was a real shift this summer, where, and again, I think as a reflection of popular pressure on the Canadian government, it really is unprecedented. It's the first time, I think, in the West where governments are being forced, because of popular pressure, to make some moves. They're not adequate. Things like the recognition of Palestine, yeah. for instance, I think is the clearest cut evidence that governments are being forced to act. And just, for instance, the fact that despite the whitewashing, we now have 50% of people in this country who understand and believe that what Israel is doing in Gaza is a genocide.
Yeah.
I mean, that's remarkable considering the kind of coverage we've had in the last 2 years from yeah. the press. So I think that's a testament to the organizing that, you know, all of you and movements across this country have done.
Students and popular resistance. Is there anything in terms of the toolbook that you have published with Jason that you would say that everyday people should do in terms of protesting or changing the media?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think signing up for CJPME's, I forget the exact name of it, but it's a media accountability project. Yes. And they, you know, give guidance and coaching to people who want to write complaints and critiques into the media. And it has an impact, because Jason certainly gets letters that I can't talk about from high up CBCers who are really hot and bothered because of the kind of coordinated campaigns that are being done. So it really has an impact, and it's worth. I mean, the truth is that ultimately, like, you know, our public broadcaster, which is a, you know, scared of its own shadow these days, and the corporate media are not going to change overnight. I mean, their dictates are set by their for-profit, you know, motives, and they are fully interlinked with, you know, the corporate power structure. But all the same, they can't ignore movements as big as the ones we've had in Canada last year.
Yeah, and as you said, you know, that there is a diversity of opinion within them, too scared oftentimes to voice their dissent, but this kind of pressure from without gives them a little more wiggle room to expand the bandwidth of coverage, right? So it works. It can work in two ways, not explicitly changing policy so much as empowering people who are still there who
yes.
want to do something else to actually take a little more riskier approach to the media. So, yeah. And I think you also wanted to talk about Canadian politics and how Canada's and the left is responding to the situation in Gaza and Palestinian recognition after this last election.
Yeah, I mean, I think Carney recognizing the state of Palestine in the same way that, you know, France and the UK did, I think is as a direct result of the popular pressure being brought to bear on these governments. As we well know, they're, you know, recognizing Palestine with one hand while with the other hand still encouraging
Israel, genocide, yeah.
denying the genocide and is you know, keeping the arms flowing, providing diplomatic backing for Israel at the UN. So, you know, they're giving with one hand while taking away with the other. But it's clear to me that, yeah, they have been forced to take steps, even if they are symbolic at this point, but they're still taking steps nevertheless. And I think that's a really important sign that that we are having an impact. And to my mind, it creates some decision dilemmas for these Western states like Canada. For instance, if, you know, with Trump's blessing, Israel does try to annex the West Bank, that now is a state. It's no longer just a occupied territory. So it will invoke certain obligations of governments like Canada's that will now just be a little harder to evade.
Yeah, and even Lametti said, well, we're waiting for the International Court of Justice to finally, it's already declared in January, you know, 2024, that plausible genocide was taking place, but they want the official designation. However, after that, the International Court of Justice has already basically admitted and affirmed that what Israel's carrying out everywhere in the occupied territories is totally illegal, according to the Geneva Convention and all other rulings in by the General Assembly, etc. So everything they're doing is illegal. And so if Canada is holding its breath and saying, you know, we have to wait to a final determination, that has already been determined. And I think that's something we have to hold the Canadian government accountable for, because it's not just been determined by the International Criminal Court, the illegality of settlement, the failure to make reparations, the displacement of people, but then it was ratified by the General Assembly. So it's gone through those hoops. So whether genocide itself has not been ratified, you know, if Canada, after this recognition, fails to make good on the determinations that are already out there, it can even dismiss, of course, the latest UN study by the commission that monitors the occupied territories in favor of the International Criminal Court. But the International Criminal Court is now firm on this point, rendering everything that's going on totally illegal according to international law that supposedly Canada subscribes to. So in terms of, you know, pushing this further in terms of the Canadian politics, future NDP, future Canadian left in this current moment, given the monster to the south of Canada.
I think we're politically in an interesting time, to say the least. It has been harrowing to watch the Carney government rushing as fast as it can to the right to cave into all of Trump's demands, to pilfer Pierre Poilievre's playbook. So I think actually we're in an interesting moment where the space has opened up for a distinct, truly progressive alternative. And while the NDP has been quite a bit more decent than they used to be on Palestine, there's been several MPs who have, spoken with real moral clarity about what is unfolding in Gaza. I'm excited about this leadership race because I think with a truly forthright and distinct progressive alternative, I think it would shake things up even further if there was a political party that was truly an arm of the Palestinian Solidarity Movement, and I think that would bring a new kind of pressure onto the Liberal government as well as its, you know, de facto partners in the Conservative Party.
Is there anything else you'd like to mention? We should open it up to our audience.
I was just wondering if anybody's done kind of a brief history of Bob Rae's voting habits at the UN, and juxtaposing it with international laws.
CJPME actually has a detailed grid that they keep up to date on their website. It's worth checking out. And we actually, at the breach, we turned it into a short video where we tabulated the hundreds of times that Canada has voted in line with the U.S. backing Israel and its annexation, impunity, violation of international law in the occupied territories. And under Trudeau, that pattern has persisted. I mean, it's a pattern that dates back really to the 50s and 60s when our media was a bit more honest. It described Canada as Israel's second best friend after the United States. There's been recently the odd UN resolution that Canada has shifted its vote on, but overwhelmingly it still is in a very tiny group of countries alongside the U.S. and sometimes a few, Pacific island protectorates that the U.S. can blackmail into voting with them. So it's truly a shameful record at the U.N. and Bob Rae has only continued that.
Would you like to?
I don't want to sound naive. I understand the corporate, the money thing, the arms, and so forth. But what is the stranglehold Israel has on Canada and the West? Why would our media be so willing to basically lie when there's evidence in front of them? What is it that is perpetuating such a profound loss of humanity and just unbelievable behavior in terms of both our countries? And the media is only one channel. We have all the other ways of doing it too.
I totally take your point. I wouldn't describe it as a stranglehold, because I think that gets it reversed. I think Israel has, since World War II, and especially since 67, they have served as very reliable client state of the U.S. and in turn Canada, and they perform their functions and their services very effectively, and that includes things like ensuring that the United States and the West have control over the strategic oil reserves in the region, that they function as a check on independent Arab nationalism. And once upon a time, they performed a function helping arm reactionary movements across South America. Now one of their, more recent functions is to serve as basically a high-tech laboratory for training and testing all the weaponry that eventually gets shipped to the West and Europe on Gazans and on Palestinians. And we have to understand that it's not the tail that wags the dog. Israel serves its imperial masters and therefore is given a very long leash. And that leash includes doing whatever they want to Palestinians. The truth is the Canadian government has other client states, and America does certainly too. And when allied states, whether it's Colombia or Haiti or states across the world, Canada turns a blind eye to what it does to its victims. I mean, the same can be said for the hundreds of thousands of Yemenis civilians who were murdered by the Saudi government with full backing by the Canadian government. We've been sending them billions in weaponry without a peep of concern for the lives of those in Yemen. So I think if anything, what is unfolding in terms of the media coverage in Gaza is not exceptional. I think it just proves the rule and really lights up the structural problems with Western media when it comes to the way it dehumanizes our colonial victims. I think a book like this could be written about the way that Canadian media monstrifies Haitians, for the crime of having defied Canadian, French, and American imperialism in that country for generations. In the same way, they're cast in different terms. They're not cast as bloodthirsty. They're cast as savage and incapable of governing their country. So I think if anything, what's happening to the Gazans, if the Gazans really just proves this colonial rule.
I also think, you know, political scientists like John Mearsheimer have always made the point that, you know, Israel is not in the U.S. best interest. And, you know, it's just disagree. You have a global supply chain of the military-industrial complex. Israel is completely intertwined in it. Gulf states want that technology as well as Canada. It uses it. You know, Silicon Valley is just, you know, another hub of all of this. And in many ways, I mean, I feel that Palestine is like, has become this punching bag for the world to show what happens when you defy this. I mean, it's so embedded. Israel is so embedded in this military-industrial system. And the, you know, it's impossible. I mean, it's impossible almost to extricate them without self-destructing Canada's, you know, military system, and certainly the United States. And this has been going back decades. I mean, I had a friend who was actually in Signals. She joined the military, a rare friend of mine, and she was in Signals in the U.S. military. And she said, you know, the Israelis just used to walk in and out, you know. They didn't have to have any clearance whatsoever. So there's this almost seamless way in which this military technology works. That, and without mentioning, of course, in Canada, the Canada-Israel Free Trade
Yes.
Agreement, you know, which has also merged certain aspects of Canadian economy with the Israeli, you know, that would prove to be very disruptive if it were annulled.
Yeah, no, I mean, that point is an excellent one, because in some ways, Israel is not an independent state. It's an appendage of the American Empire. Some people describe it as the fifth like naval fleet. U.S. has four in the region, and Israel is the fifth. And it's an incredibly profitable client state to have. I mean, another really important connection, apart from the free trade, is Canadian investment. And Stephen Harper is someone who has made it his almost like essential mission post serving as prime minister to become an investor through Oz Ventures in high Israeli military-based high tech. And we've documented that in the breach. It's not in this book, but for instance, through Oz Ventures, his company is the one that helped incubate the high tech surveillance that is being used against Gazans right now. And it hasn't been exported to Canada yet, but it has since been exported to Greece, where the Greek government is now implementing that same tech to spy on its migrants that are detained in its offshore prisons. So that's the way in which it's incredibly profitable, and that tech eventually makes its way around the world, too.
Yeah. Matthew?
Well, first of all, I make a note that we have a vigil every Wednesday, 4 to 5.
Can you speak up?
We have a vigil every Wednesday at 4 to 5. If anybody comes away and feels they need to do something, every Wednesday, 4 to 5, we have a vigil at Princess and Bath, you know, where the entire used to be. And you're all welcome to come. You don't have to sign anything. Just be there and hold up signs. I do have a comment or a question. It's really a question. I have to answer. You know, this government has said we're going to spend $30 billion on arms, on weapons, right? But we know throughout the past multiple years, we couldn't spend any money on housing. We can't spend any money on the post office. We can't spend any money on colleges. We can't spend can't meet our health care needs because it'll be too inflationary. And yet nowhere in the media has anybody said, well, isn't this going to be inflationary? So I wonder, what is the dynamic? How does it happen that out of the thousands of well-educated, perhaps not so well-educated, but supposedly well-educated analysts and commentators and journalists, no one, everybody falls into line. And it's one thing, I understand, okay. We had a demonstration against Queen the other day, put on by the students and faculty, asking Queens to divest. And what was Queens' excuse for not divesting? We have to be neutral. So that's like, we understand how it works in the elite. But what is not clear to me is how it works its way down. You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, I mean, the truth is it would be a surprise if they acted differently. I mean, the mainstream media are large corporations, and it would frankly be a surprise if they reported in any different way on other large corporations. In many cases, they're imbricated in terms of, you know, who sits on each other's boards. But very quickly, if they were to start reporting critically on how the oil industry or the high-tech industry or the weapons industry is behaving, the owners would get an earful. And, you know, it's the owners who hire the publishers and the upper-level managers. And, I mean, they don't tell their journalists how to report, but the only way you get a high-level position in those places is if you start to internalize the same perspectives and priorities of the ownership class in the media. So there are, you know, the odd brave individuals who try to buck that trend, but they are a minority. And that ultimately is the reason why you don't build media that aren't on a for-profit basis, who are only accountable to their readers, progressive readers. You're not going to be able to build a countervailing tendency in the press. What was the other question?
What was the other question, Matthew?
Well, that's it.
I mean, I've seen it happen I've seen it happen firsthand among peers. I won't name the name, but I used to work at an independent magazine called The Dominion, and we had a young, super smart journalist who wanted to have a career in the mainstream media. And at the time, he was very critical about, you know, issues that are dear to ours, supportive of the Palestinians. But I remember that as soon as he started hanging out with those mainstream journalists, as he was trying to get a job there, you know, he started to slowly acculturate and shift. And I remember this was in 2012 in Montreal, where we had this giant student strike. And I remember I bumped into him once, and he said, I haven't seen you around anymore. He said, I can't be seen at the demonstrations. That would compromise my objectivity. You know, by and by, that's the kind of, you know, small concessions, mental concessions that you start to make. That's, I think, the only way that you can eventually rationalize to yourself the work that you do in the mainstream media. My sense is that the people who do get stories through are the ones who are completely cynical and clear-eyed about the system that they work under. There are those kinds of journalists working in Canada's mainstream media. They don't always last long because it's very tiring and exhausting doing that kind of work, but they know the moments when they can push the stories through.
Who are some of them?
I mean, some of them probably wouldn't want to be named, the ones who do the kind of news reporting. There are people who have been able to find a perch who don't have to make those compromises, and that's usually thanks to the strength of social movements that have forced those openings. So I think of someone like Shri Pratikar at the Toronto Star, who I think is able to write that way because there's such a forceful movement for Palestinian liberation. I also think of, you know, probably the instance, not about Palestine, but of a very telling shift in the way mainstream media covers an issue, is the kind of change you saw in the mainstream media in the wake of Idle No More. This incredible indigenous rights uprising that, you know, our country experienced. In its aftermath, you saw, not just in media, but in cultural industries across the scope, new openings, and new platforms for Indigenous artists, musicians, writers, all of whom were producing incredible art and writing before. But in the wake of the impact that social movements made, journalists, like media outlets, had to afford them a place. So I think of someone like Tanya Talaga, you know, an incredible Indigenous journalist who now has a column at the Globe and Mail. That would have been inconceivable.